This is Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. And there's more. All book-books.com's Musings from Between the Lines Substack. Part 5 of Jonathan Crary's book Scorched Earth by Verso Press. Because the last chapter deals much with the visual, it got me to look back at one of my books, Photo Albums of the Heart Mind, which is a collection of short essays, little 1-2 page little bits, and approaches how the visual has affected the consciousness, especially in America, from the stylized pictures of Edward Curtis of Native peoples always kind of posing. And my book traces in a loose fashion the impact of how images affect us. Thus the title is Photo Albums of the Heart Mind, the images of our lives that we carry within us, in our hearts and minds, if not in a actual photo album. So some of the book goes into the history of photography with examples of the different types of prints and the evolution of that. And that leapfrogged into the motion pictures in Hollywood. So some of my sort of loose thesis is how the visual has affected our consciousness in a way. It's sped up. We started to watch, you know, from the pictures to the motion pictures, things got sped up. And we started to look at the images rather than the actual experiences. So that's been exacerbated with the technology and the screens now, and what Crary talks about, and especially with the eye, the study of the eye movements. So that got me to want to read a page from Photo Albums of the Heart Mind. It's called Backtrack to the Future. William Randolph Hearst, the poster boy for the media conglomerates that, as of this writing, control the bulk of what people see, hear, read, listen to, touch, publish, and get their news from, General Electric, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, CBS, National Amusements, Comcast, Sony, and Hearst Communications. Newspaper owners Hearst, San Francisco, and Joseph Pulitzer, New York, popularized, quote, yellow journalism. Yellow ink was used as part of the sensationalizing. And they media war-hawked the country into the Spanish-American War in 1898. The mindset of empire was not new, but the burgeoning mainstream media amplified it. In 1941, Frank Luther Mott's book, American Journalism, identified the blueprint for yellow journalism. Now, this amazed me because this is 1941. It applies today even more so with the screens, as Crary shows with the study of the eye tracking. Number one, scare headlines in huge print, often of minor news. Number two, lavish use of pictures or imaginary drawings. Nowadays, with AI, you can no longer trust any image that you see in the news on the screen. You cannot trust any of it. It could be accurate, but it may not be. So that's what I mean. You can no longer trust any image. Number three, use of faked interviews, misleading headlines, pseudoscience, and a parade of false learning from so-called experts. Wow, I'm still amazed, even though I studied this in 1941. Emphasis on full-color Sunday supplements, usually with comic strips. Have you ever noticed that? Like sometimes the news, when they flash CNN, they'll flash their three stories. It's like, you know, some ecological tragedy, and then, you know, somebody slept with somebody, and then, you know, best new grills for summertime. And it's like, it's just a cognitive dissonance of, you know, tragedy and mundane. Number five, dramatic sympathy for the underdog against the system. And then I added, rather than actually changing the system. Wow, that's like, there's Donald Trump's campaign right there. Dramatic sympathy with the underdog against the system. Again, in 1941, this was the blueprint as I call it, the blueprint for yellow journalism. Eventually, corporate TV news would merge with tabloid journalism, and breaking news became a famous person getting out of an airplane upon arrival at a foreign location. Yawn. The supermarket tabloid grabs attention while you wait online. The lazy mind grabs a bit of news online on the go. The mainstream corporate media has two basic tactics. Sin of omission, you'll rarely hear ever, except in dramatized fashion about native peoples, the original peoples of this land. And what they claim of others is what they themselves do or want to hide. The supposed Russiagate meddling in presidential election affairs ignored the WikiLeaks news that it was the Democratic Party sabotaging Bernie Sanders' bid. Or a leak, but not a hack. Plus, Republican vote riggings for Donald J. Trump, not to mention voter purging of minorities, according to investigative journalist Greg Palast. So again, it's like a sin of omission, or they project onto other people what they themselves do. That's repeated. I've seen that over and over in the past month. I'd have to go back to look. And then some of Hollywood's moving pictures, the first film shown, The Birth of a Nation, originally called The Klansman, pro Ku Klux Klan, the first 12 reel film, R-E-E-L, and first film shown in the White House. And Gore Vidal wrote on his book jacket notes, "In Hollywood has Hollywood, America's other capital, is perfecting the art of image making. And America, on the eve of its plummet from isolation and its subsequent rise to world hegemony." So there you have, like, the same tactics. Hollywood, Jimmy Dore reported on that recently, CIA involvement, and a lot, they vet the films. They vet a lot of your favorite films if you watch that stuff. So this whole sense of image and manipulating the visual is nothing new, except maybe to the native peoples who've been here for thousands of years, and the advent of photography with the different, you know, plates and such like. That's another aspect of it, but the whole thing is this manipulation of our images and our visuals, in my opinion, at the expense of true vision, dream vision, meditation, deep insight, critical thinking, and all that stuff. And jumping back into queries, here's a phrase in quotes, in their, quote, cognitive e-commerce division. That's an oxymoron. Their cognitive e-commerce division, the stated goal is to build, quote, deeper human engagement by knowing what our customers want before they do, by understanding nuances of tone, sentiment, and environmental conditions. We can engage customers on a human level and deliver the right experience at the perfect moment to inspire lifelong advocacy. Wow, it's just so deep. The bullshit is so deep that they their focus, again, is not on the actual world or the environment. And it's all about the sale. It's all about the art of the deal. Lifelong advocacy, cradle-to-grave marketing. Just the right moment, just the right timing. All to catch your eye. That's people actually do studies. I was doing an event, and someone was going to post a flyer on Facebook or Instagram, and they told me there's like they were going to check the algorithms or whatever for the optimal time. So, like, I don't know, you know, most people have dinner and they finish at 7 p.m. on Sunday, and then they check their Instagram, Facebook page. So, you know, 7:01 is the optimal time, so maybe that works, but wow, that just seems like working overtime to me. And Carreri continues, the possibility of a common life of direct experience has been replaced by passive receptivity to streams of stimuli that are imposed on us non-consensually. And that's the topic of the follow-up book to Photo Albums of the Heart Mind, is the moving through the empty gate. I talk much about the phrase that I plucked from the Zen tradition, direct experience. Eye tracking is an essential tool for UXD designers because it indicates what features in a display or controlled environment are most, quote, eye-catching. Usually this correlates to what is recorded as a user's, quote, first fixation. This is simultaneously cross-referenced with, quote, gaze time. Blinks, scrolling, and clicking patterns, and other layers of information. Paradoxically, an eye-catching visual object is also one that is shallow and without complexity. So here it is, the lack of critical thinking, and the programming is programming people for a short attention span. Immediate or effortless perceptual grasp. Eye tracking would detect a hesitancy, a kind of, quote, stammering of eye movement that even relatively briefly is unable to settle into a secure fixation. But such minor sources of visual uncertainty and vagueness are corrected or removed in order to optimize usability. Thus, the most disturbing consequences of eye tracking have less to do with surveillance and privacy than with the devaluation and routinization of vision. This is what I call the opposite of Zen, what he describes. One of the broader goals of eye tracking is the training of an observer user into probable patterns of performativity. Anything that encourages prolonged attention or even partially contemplative states is unacceptable because of the indefinitely longer amount of time such a response might take up. At the same time, eye movement that is vacillating or aimless is behavior to be deterred or redirected. We often assume that internet surfing means the possibility of following random, uncharted visual itineraries, but in most instances, this is only a pseudo-wandering that is, in fact, tracing a predictable sequence of fixation points interspersed with habitual patterns of scrolling and clicking. Like the phrase, to navigate a website, surfing connotes an open, aqueous milieu, but the reality is repetitive itineraries devoid of actual drift or waywardness. Now, this is something I've seen kids do, and I do it. I experience it a lot. I think it's part of being an artist and also someone who meditates. It's sort of like, I don't know, I can't quite put the words to it. It's like not even just gazing out the window. It's just almost like looking out the window without looking out the window, where my consciousness just goes somewhere else, but I'm conscious to know that I'm in this kind of zone, and that's often what fosters some insight or a creative bit. So that, in effect, is what they're literally, this technology is literally, in that regard, neurologically and physically and mentally, and then one has to add spiritually and emotionally, attempting to dumb us down and, you know, make us clickbait information sound bites kind of conversations, and shopaholics. Staring fixedly at the confined space of what is encompassed by the instrument he holds, Newton sits blinkered from the overwhelming sensory plurality of the world, tragically cut off from the visionary powers inherent in all human beings. For Blake, single vision was the merely mechanical activity of the eye, isolated from interplay with the other senses and the imagination. The separation of the senses, which Marx was also to describe, became an integral part of the industrialization of perception. Now there's a great phrase, industrialization of perception, that took off in the late 19th century. The filmmaker Stan Brakhage, who was influenced by Blake's mythopoeic framework, saw a related constriction of the sense in contemporary techniques for the management of vision well before the internet. Quote, most people's eyes are caught in tricks imposed by some very greedy people, so they move along certain channels of prescribed light. And the way they get tricked is that they don't look at the qualities and varieties of light. They're only trained to use it as something bouncing off objects or papers or signs. Finally, even the objects cease to exist. industrialization of perception. This is a flavor of what John Trudell talked about when he said they're mining our minds, the same way that they're mining the metals and the minerals and the resources to create the gadgets. Then the gadgets are being used to literally mine our minds. Industrialization of perception, how we see the world now. How many people just enjoy a concert or enjoy a sunset or enjoy a gathering without having to take a photo? Nothing wrong with the photos. They're nice. I like to have a photo to remember the event by. However, when you see how many people do that and constantly, it sure makes me wonder, are they actually experiencing it? Or are they, you know, going to go home and look at it and then maybe experience what they didn't experience? Pre-modern cultures, with few exceptions, were shaped by primal awareness of light as a form of energy that interacts powerfully with matter. Light was understood to possess transformative powers that were consistently spiritual or regenerative. So this again gets into the in-depth awarenesses of the original peoples and all our ancestry and our heritages and our deeper experiences. Here he gets into a very interesting scientific flavor. Many overlook the fateful consequences of the rapid discovery of what is generally accepted today as the electromagnetic spectrum. From 1886 to 1914, there was a quickening accumulation of research developments that led to some of the foundations of the techno-political social world we inhabit more than a century later. A cursory outline of those years would include the work of Hertz, radio waves, Roentgen, X-rays, Becquerel and the Curies, radioactivity, Villard, and then Rutherford and Bohr, gamma rays. However, these discoveries and their irrevocable remaking of visibility did not occur fortuitously or as part of some disinterested quest for greater scientific knowledge. This familiar constellation of names sustains the popular narrative of theoretical and practical breakthroughs made by individual geniuses. But the reality is of gifted individuals working within what Max Weber identified as state capitalist enterprises. That is, within the new institutional complexes specific to the nation states, then competing for territorial and economic domination on a global scale. The annexation of the electromagnetic spectrum coincided with the professionalism and specialization of science, and with the demands of militarism, economic growth, and imperial expansion for new forms of energy, communication, and destruction. Of course, one of the most important developments of that 1886 to 1914 period was the research on the radioactive properties of uranium. Most importantly, these developments have led to the industries of social control and mass lethal violence. And then he jumps to the iris scanning. So that's a lot. That's a lot right there to ponder. I'm finding this, like, you can see how dense, what I mean by dense, the writing is. There's a lot to it in a short amount of pages. There again is not only the industrialization of the perception, but then also the way that gets utilized in the geopolitics, competing for territorial and economic domination. So this technology then becomes a competition, and who has access to the technology, as the Chris Hedges interview with various workers from Microsoft, Meta, and what was the other one? Maybe Facebook, I forgot. Talking about that Israel was able to utilize the technology to promote the genocide, but comments about Palestinians were not allowed. So there's the competing for territorial and economic domination right there. So a lot of these things require a deeper looking, no pun intended, into, first of all, the ways that the manipulation is happening, and then the ramifications of that. So not just necessarily your perceptions of the world, but your perceptions of the world and what is being projected as what we call the world out there. So I think those are two prongs to consider, at least. There may be more, but the way we see the world, the way we can see a sunset, or we can run over to get the camera to photo, the cell phone to photograph the sunset, and then how we perceive what's going on in the world based on what the media conglomerates and the Hollywood are putting out to us to perceive. So, yeah, that's a lot to think about or not think about. My suggestion would be to think deeply about it, or go into a meditative place and just contemplate what's going on and look at your own perception. That's what Zen meditation does. It encourages people to examine their own mental processes, like being your own mental therapist. I know when I first started meditating a lot, I remember sitting there and like the first 10 minutes, I realized how much my mind was hooked on, you know, necessary but very mundane things. You know, does my hair look all right? Did I leave the coffee pot on? What am I going to wear? Is it cold out? Am I well? You know, it was like all that chatter, and it took a while before that just kind of quieted down and I got into a deeper places. So whatever way that you get into those deeper places, whether it's walking in the woods or just sitting quietly wherever you are, that, in my opinion, is some of the antidote to this visual manipulation and distorting of the world and our perception. Because when we see clearly, we can then help nurture what's actually nurturing and not destructive. This is a postscript because I just saw the Bob Dylan film, A Complete Unknown. It's an excellent film portraying his early years getting to New York, and then when he went electric, and the changes the havoc that happened at the time and the changes that happened. But in context of this podcast, before the film, I found it quite fascinating. The AMC movie theater promo fits exactly with what this episode is talking about. So the movie theater was touting, you know, the film industry touting the laser light, some new kind of you know, technology that they have, and the Hollywood magic, and they used phrases like details so flawless, pure, superior, having to do with a sustainable future. So that's a buzzword, sustainable future. But the whole sense of the Hollywood magic and the images so flawless, so pure, and so superior, as if you can't tell the difference between actual vision, actual life vision, and the movie, is basically what it was saying. So that fits very much with this whole topic of the photographs and the Hollywood and the motion pictures and the virtual realities. The film is based on reality, but the way that it's promoted and the way the films are promoted is this, you know, other alternative kind of world that the images present to people. So I felt that's very important to add, that stuff, just the boasting of it continues as the technology continues. And the only note about the film I'll add is a wonderful film, and not a qualm with the film, you know, itself, but the history. There's one scene that Pete Seeger is very courageously refuses to name names during the communist Red Scare when he was before Congress, and then outside, in front of the people, he sings. He takes out his banjo and he sings, "This land is my land. This land is your land." So. Overall, Woody Guthrie, wonderful repertoire, and you know, the main influence that started Dylan's career. But that song is erroneous, because it's a false image, because it wasn't my land, your land, as the song sings. It's native people's lands and Turtle Island. So yeah, that, but that's just the snippet of history, not having to do with the movie itself, even though they did choose to put that in, but that's, you know, an accurate bit of history. But overall, the film's worth seeing, and yeah, keep your vision pure and clear. Thanks for listening. Be well.